communities of color. Up to now, many legislators have made decisions about climate and not considered equity. And I think your resolution would be improved by a couple sentences on that topic, and I'll leave it to you to come up with those sentences. The second thing I'd like to suggest is that Warm Springs is in really critical need right now of help due to their water situation and COVID. There was an article on Oregon Public Broadcasting. I sent it to Jen, and maybe she has sent it to you anyway. I don't know if there's any way the city can help with Warm Springs right now, but if there is anything we can do, it is sure be the time to do it. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. All right. That's all we had for business from the audience. We'll go ahead and open the work session. Do we have any agenda additions or corrections?
No, Mayor, we do not.
Okay. I think there was a letter. Let me see if this was added in here already. From the Energy Council, were we going to add that in?
Mayor, I believe you were going to address that under Mayor Call.
Okay, we'll just do that under Mayor Call. Okay. So the council resolution discussion items. So we have, we had three people on our subcommittee. So would you guys from the subcommittee like to kind of go over how you came up with what you have? I think it's great, by the way, but you might give us some feedback on your process. Whoever wants to go first.
I'll try.
Okay.
I think we took what we had heard in the past two meetings, along with work that we've been doing, at goal setting and in previous years, and tried to build that all together into a coherent direction of where we thought we heard council was hoping to go. Obviously turned out longer than I think some of us had hoped, but we had a lot to say on it. But I think it's valuable to talk about. This is not, this sort of resolution is not coming out of left field. That is a direction I think council has been moving towards for a number of years, probably since before I was on here. But with the Inclusive City Resolution, with the County ID program, I think even in our climate resolution where we did acknowledge the impact on vulnerable populations. And so really figuring out how to take the next steps, given everything we've seen in the last few months, I think does require us to really make it clear what we have been doing and what we need to do. But Tim and Jessica, if you want to add on to that.
I think you pretty much summed it up there, Megan. That was great.
Thank you, Megan. And I'm sure the three of us could answer any questions from the other counselors.
Okay, great. I think it is a little bit long. I was hoping to be about a page and a half, but there was a lot of things that needed to be said. So that's how it ended up being this long. I think it dovetails pretty well with our Sanctuary City. I mean, it's a resolution that we had. It seems like it, there's nothing at cross purposes with that. It just kind of continues on with what we had said about that. It just goes further than that one did, I believe, and rightly should. And so I think it's a great resolution. I think there's some definite things in here that, we had discussed or had talked about the last time that we thought were important things, that we value peaceful demonstrations where all people feel safe to express their opinions and recognize that the open display of firearms can be perceived as threatening and cause fear. I think that was stated at one or two of our meetings, and this captures that sentiment. I think there was, you know, we've talked about doing some education and of the staff, but we might also, the only thing under that is I was thinking maybe we should just say that we would talk about education of staff and council so that, you know, we can all be included in the diversity, equity, and inclusion discussions and what all those mean. So I would love to do some more of that training myself. And so we might add that in there on that one. And I think one of the other things that's that I think was a, you know, one of these resolves that I really thought was important. Hood River City Council explicitly denounces actions that detract from a sense of community safety, including any forms of intimidation and harassment. I think all of these are great, but those were a couple that stood out for me that I really was impressed with those particular ones, and I thought they were important. Others? Do you guys have comments on things that you'd want to consolidate, add on, make a point to say something about? Mark?
I think you guys are really close. Were we going to try to edit it now and pass it tonight? Because my proposed edits might change if that's true.
Rachel, yeah. Is that?
That's really up to council how you'd like to handle it. I think having the discussion now is just a fine option. Yeah. It's really up to the mayor.
Yeah, I think let's spend a little bit of time on this and see if we have a few edits. And, you know, if they get really complicated and we have a lot of them, then we might want to, send those edits or potential edits to the subcommittee or to Rachel, and then she could do track changes on that and we could get it back and then, you know, maybe go through it one more time if we have a lot. But I think we could just try and go through it tonight if possible.
Okay. So I too was hoping to get it within a few pages. To me, if it's one sheet of paper that is a little more digestible, if it can't be, then that's okay. And it can be longer, but, as a goal for a resolution, that seems like a good starting point. I thought to get there, the first two whereases are, referencing the same resolution, and so maybe they could be combined in a way to save a little space. And the last and third from last on the first page seem very similar to me, so they could be combined possibly, not taking away the message but just trying to combine them. I think that the mayor's pledge is a be it resolved, but it's in the past tense. So I think it's should be a whereas.
Which one is that on? Is this in the second page?
One, two, three, four, fifth one from the bottom on the second page.
Oh, okay.
I thought that the one right above that and two above that were very similar. One is talking about policies ingrained in city policies, and the other one is city programs and services, and those seem pretty similar to me, and maybe that's an opportunity. And the second from the bottom on the second page, I think methods of peaceful community debate, hopefully, not. And I sort of like the idea of referencing the, because of the interconnectedness of all things, you know, a short bullet referencing the the climate resolution does touch on equity things, right? Because as climate change happens, we already see data that says that the poorest among us are the ones that get screwed the mostest. So I think it's a reasonable thing to have a reference, just acknowledging that because climate change also affects those of us that in the most need, our resolution, blah, 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 is, you know, another way that we're attempting to walk our talk, right? So I don't think it has to be long, but I think this is pretty powerful, and I think it's clear that we mean it, and so I'm supportive of the effort. So.
Okay, I think I caught most of those. I was looking at what you were talking about combining. There was one of them that, but for the climate change one, I think you said it was the third from the bottom or fifth from the bottom on the second page.
Are you going to be the note taker, Kate?
I'm just trying to see which ones kind of might go together, and then we can talk about whether we all think they go together or whatever.
All right. So the first two on the first page.
Combine, right? Possible combine.
The last and third from last on the first page.
Okay.
And the one, two, three, the fourth and sixth ones on the second page.
Okay.
And those are my only combined. The seventh one on the second page is the mayor's pledge. And I think that moves up to the whereas section.
Whereas, okay.
And then the second from the bottom on the second page, I think it's other methods of community debate.
Put peaceful in there.
I would qualify what kind of debate. So.
Okay. Let's get additional comments before we go into trying to change anything, because there might be some people that want to add or subtract or combine too. Eric?
Sure. Happy to provide some thoughts. Commend the subcommittee for clearly rolling up its sleeves. You can tell from the length, which I appreciated it's long, but I guess a lot of effort was put in. I just thought it was thoughtful, reflect a lot of our core values in our diverse community, and I just look forward to supporting this. I had a few nits to suggest for the group to consider. Some of them actually Mark precisely hit, I guess, in reverse order. I too was struck that the word peaceful might be right before community debate on the second to last paragraph on second page. Just looking at my notes here. The mayor actually mentioned that, I think you did, Mayor, that perhaps we should have city council join in the diversity trainings and the inclusion trainings. I would welcome that. It seems if we as council are going to direct city employees to participate in, we shouldn't somehow be above it. I've personally been involved in these through my employment, but that's welcome participating in another one. So I would join the mayor suggesting that addition. And the other one has to do with the second to last paragraph on the first page, where we are referencing that the open display of firearms can be perceived as threatening and cause fear. And I know that particular paragraph, some people might read that and go different directions. I like the way it's written. I think whoever framed this put a lot of thought into it, and I accept as true. And I think we all know dreadful Monday evening of several weeks ago that it did cause fear. I was going to suggest, because there were different dynamics involved in that evening, the phrasing that are adding, not subtracting, but adding to say, that the council recognizes that the use of social media to encourage non-peaceful activities and the open display of firearms can be perceived as threatening and cause fear. So that was going to be my suggestion for that, is adding again the phrase, quote, use of social media to encourage non-peaceful activities could be a constructive addition to that particular paragraph. So those are my thoughts, and I again commend the subcommittee for its work.
Thank you, Eric. Gladys?
Yeah, overall, I like it. I like some of the changes that have been presented by my peers. And I've been sitting here thinking like, oh, should I bring this up or should I not? But I feel like I have to. On that second page, the very last one, the one that the mayor highlighted, we denounce any actions that detract from a sense of community safety, including any forms of intimidation or harassment. And I highlight that one simply because, you know, we're all here on a volunteer basis to make meaningful changes in our community. And over the last couple weeks, I can say that my experiences in regards to simply my existence of just being on this council have been questioned, and have I've received just a lot of negative backlash and negative attention, again, for simply having a seat at this table. And I don't have any intentions of going anywhere for those individuals that want me out of here so badly. These are 2 pages long, but these are all changes that have to happen, because we're growing and we are simply trying to be better and to push ourselves to be better. And hopefully by making all of these changes, other cities, other counties, other communities will follow action so that we can be a little more unified moving forward. So that being said, to those individuals that just really want me to be remove myself from council, I'm not going to do so. When you write to the mayor, make sure that you're writing the mayor to let her know that it's Gladys Rivera, and not Grace Rivera. That's not my name. So I just wanted to highlight on that last one. I'm not going anywhere. So thank you.
Thanks, Gladys. So we've had input from everyone on the resolution. That's fantastic. Does anyone have any objections to kind of combining some of these that kind of the they're very similar? We wouldn't take out any language. We just add them as a, you know, a comma or an and, where they kind of seem to talk in similarities about the same type of thing.
Is it possible for us to, like, the subcommittee to go back and incorporate these changes and then bring it back? I do want to follow up on Mark and actually Peter's comment about the climate change aspect of this too, and I think that would be an important addition to have in there, a whereas and a be it resolved.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fine with doing that. If you guys could do that before the next meeting, and we could hopefully finalize it at the next meeting. I'd like to get our resolution done as quickly as we can, but if we could get it done by the next meeting, it seems like that would be great.
I mean, I think we could do that. I guess, yeah, my preference would be to pass it sooner rather than later, but if we've got enough edits, I would certainly have time as a subcommittee to work on it.
Okay. I've got one. Go ahead, Tim.
Is there a way to pass it and without making the changes? I mean, because, I mean, combining these things would be, you know, on the fly would be hard. You know, that's I suppose it could be done, but I mean, I'm not sure exactly sure. You know, instantaneously combining several of these things into one that would be a difficult thing to do.
Yeah, I think we're probably going to have to go edit it and bring it back.
Yeah.
For the next one.
And our next meeting is in 2 weeks, correct? I believe. Yeah. I mean, we don't have a long period, a 3 week time this time, so it's only two.
If it's my comments to combine a few of these things, that's the difference. If that was the only thing that pushed us to the next meeting, I would live with that second piece of paper. That's for sure. So, I don't know.
Well, I think we've got a couple of the things that we were going to add in here. You know, we're going to change the whereas. We're going to add counselors plus employees for the education. We're going to do the climate change thing. And if we add the part that Eric added in about the use of social media to encourage non-peaceful activities. I mean, I think there's enough of other things than just combining that maybe we should do a rewrite on it.
So I guess, we've got, each person had comments. Does everyone else on council, or I guess four or more of us, agree with each of those comments before we as a subcommittee go and do them?
Yeah, you know, I like Mark's and Eric's idea of kind of, there's always ways to make things more succinct. If succinctness is important, and certainly we can achieve that. Having said that, addressing several hundred years of racism in two pages doesn't seem like a lot.
Yeah, I think we should rewrite it. But you're right, Megan. I think we should kind of say, okay, we all agree with the changes that everyone came up with. Before you guys go back and put it together, just if everyone has a head nod that they're okay with everything that was suggested. And if you don't, you know, please speak up that, you know, if you don't like some portion that someone suggested, then we should speak up now.
Is there a way that all of this can get edited? I mean, I guess reviewed through the next week and a half, so by the time that we do meet in 2 weeks, we don't have to debate on this much longer. I mean,
that's what I assume would happen, Gladys. Yeah, that we've kind of all agreed to the changes. We'll do the word changes, and then when we bring it back, we'll be ready to pass it. Yeah, at the next meeting. All right. I don't see anyone disagreeing. Oh, Megan.
I don't know if it's disagreeing, but Eric's addition about social media, you know, encouraging non-peaceful activities, and I know, you know, we're obviously referencing a specific event with that, but any encouragement of non-peaceful activities, whether it was on social media or through other sources of media or just in person, like, would all be inappropriate. And so I'm wondering if there's, again, putting aside that I know it's about that Monday, is there a reason we want to call out social media in particular?
I assume that's a question directed to me. I think
for everyone.
Yeah, I just I think that was seemingly a contributing factor to that dreadful evening. And so it seemed to be if the council was going to speak and signal disapproval of things, it seemed appropriate for me to include that because it seemed to be part of the evening. So that's the simple answer for why I was proposing it.
I think that maybe include social media parenthetically, maybe with something else. So the point is, negative, stirring of the pot is the bad thing. Social media or other methods are fine, but social media is insidious enough right now that I think calling it out in a couple words makes sense to me.
Yeah, I'm okay with calling it out. I mean, I know it's being called out a lot lately for doing just that. Encouraging non-peaceful activities. So I don't think it's a bad thing to call it out. we can't control, you know, freedom of speech, but we can say that we don't encourage social media to encourage non-peaceful activities. I mean, I don't think it's a wrong thing to say.
All right. Sorry, I guess one more. We did get a couple comments about the supplement and support existing public safety practices. And I'm wondering if there's any other phrase folks would want in that realm.
And which one are you talking about, Megan?
Sorry. You might want to know. Page 5, the fourth resolved from the bottom. Head River will explore community-based models of safety support and prevention that could supplement and support existing public safety practices.
Oh, instead of, they didn't like the supplement or support. That was what, that's what you're talking about.
Yes. And my brain is currently frozen, but, you know, supplement support or maybe there's a third something in there. Or you know, I guess just figured I'd bring it up since we got a couple comments.
One of the other words could be modify.
Oh, modify. That might be a good word. Because modify could mean supplement, it could mean replace. It could mean change. I mean, I think modify kind of captures a lot of different things that could be done there. Okay, I've got that note down too. I just came up with one more that I didn't notice prior, but it's on page 5 down. About the training, and it says we teach about racism in the United States and in our community. I think we should put the United States and Oregon, because Oregon has a long history of racism, and I think that should be specifically called out.
But that also includes Hood River as well, right? I mean, there's...
Right, community. Hood, okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So I'm noting that as in the United States, in Oregon, and in our community.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I've taken notes so we can compare notes, Megan, and make sure we've captured everything, the two of us.
That'd be great. Thanks.
All right. Do I have maybe I could get at least head nods that everything we've talked about, everyone is agreeing to, and we will get a new draft with all these changes at the next meeting? A thumbs up or something from everyone? Gladys? Are you okay? Eric? Okay. All right. I saw the other thumbs up. Thank you. I just wanted to make sure. I didn't want to go past someone and not have captured it. Thank you so much. Great work, you guys. Housing code project update and next steps from Dustin.
Thank you, Mayor. Let me queue up a screen share here for a little presentation. All right. Hoping for the best. All right. You let me know, do we have a PowerPoint up right now?
Yes.
All right, good. Great, thank you so much. This is a work and an update that we're looking for a little input from council. This is from your 2020 work plan to work on some of the housing code updates. And it builds upon some of the previous work that we did through the transportation and growth management projects that were vetted through some of our advisory committees. And at this point, staff has gone through and requested what they call a letter proposals from our consultants groups to look at some of the prototype development intended to be included in your zoning code to increase the number of housing product types allowable in your existing zones. So using some of the input that we've gathered from 2018 and 2019, as well as some of the projects that we reviewed this year, we prepared a task list for a consultant group to better develop our middle housing product code. And again, we're looking to refine this before we begin the legislative process that will be heard before Planning Commission, again, through the legislative and hearing process, and eventually will make its way to you. Let's see. So again, before kicking off that legislative hearing, we collaborated with the University of Oregon, some of the Sustainable Cities Institute, Echo Northwest, some of our statewide partners to get a better understanding of the current statewide housing efforts that are coming into play, some of the local conditions affecting our market, some of the institutional barriers that we have in our own code that limit our middle housing product, and really some of the development forecasts that we see coming. Again, how is the current market look? A little bit of COVID influence on it, and how does this look over the next decade into 2028? So with this and other projects that the city's bringing online for housing, such as the RFP for your Rand Road purchase, the evaluation of estimates for some of the next 20 years for affordable housing, which council had looked for, is what is the estimated real estate and some of the costs that would account if we tried to put together and amass the real estate necessary to accommodate affordable housing, which really, depending on how it looks by way of product and some of the how the approach, could range anywhere between $5 and $26 million just for the real estate alone. So really, this is one approach into a series of approaches that's going to be necessary to make some inroads into your needed housing solution. But with all that in mind, we're gonna kind of narrow into a couple of things tonight. Again, looking at the middle housing code update and providing a little notice to House Bill 2001, which was passed last year, and is really going to be influential in medium and large cities and how they some of the requirements that come through on the statewide level. But to start, there's a lot of jargon around what we know as the missing middle housing. So we're going to dive into that a little. But the question, one of the questions is, what is middle housing, and why is it going to be useful in Hood River's approach and goal to address some of its needs within the city? So based on some of the preliminary input, we've gathered a little better definition that's going to help set some common ground when we talk about this. Middle housing is a range of house scale buildings with multiple units intended to be compatible in the scale and form, or otherwise known as the look and feel, with a detached single family home. Proponents of this housing type and this approach make assertions that the housing type supports a greater diversity of incomes, of household size, of age, and different preferences that really aren't necessarily all captured by the single family detached home. And it enables an inclusionary and vibrant community, which line up with some of the goals that council put in its work plan. And then it's argued that missing middle housing is often smaller and therefore generally more affordable than larger homes, both in their production as well as the end for residents. And again, that's based on size. This is not necessarily just subsidized housing. This can be both market rate, and really the approach is to introduce it into the code as as another permitted housing type. Commonly, this is more of the common terms. When we talk about middle housing, we're commonly talking about townhouses, the cottage cluster, a duplex, a triplex, and a fourplex. Those smaller housing types that really fit, again, can be scaled to fit within more of a neighborhood residential scale. So the middle housing code that we, and task list that we've come up with, and again, this is what some of the approach that we're looking at with our, to develop this code with a subject matter specialist, an urban design and planning consultant, includes setting the project foundation and goal setting, doing a code audit, which in a lot of ways we've already started with some of our previous work through the University of Oregon, as well as the mentioned transportation and growth management grants that we've received. The development of prototypes, so approximately 16, some updates. So we presume that once we do a little work, we're gonna need to realize some updates on these. And then some code amendments. So this is actually introducing this work into your code, into the regulations that set the sidebars on how these are produced, where they're produced, and the standards in which they're produced. Length, width, height, setback, what zones they're allowed in, and how do you get there? Are they permitted by building permit? Are they permitted by site plan approval, land use approval? What is the level of oversight which these become necessary to see some of these products permitted? And then this will all go into launch the legislative hearing process. So the public hearings, the work before the Planning Commission, is all going to be informed by the work that these tasks really go into creating some of the code.
Hey, Dustin?
Yes.
Prototypes, that's prototype code language for specific elements of the middle housing, is that right?
Both prototype code language and designs. So both by way of graphics as well. So it's not just a prototype by way of narrative, it's a prototype by look. Here's what four cottage style units on a 5,000 square foot lot look like. Or here's what a duplex can look like. So some physical design representations.
Gotcha. That goes into the new code.
Yep.
Okay.
So hopefully those, the picture says 1,000 words. I hope those pictures will be able to speak thousands of words without having to define them in the typical code way. The designs are also really democratic. You don't have to be able to unravel the narrative of planning jargon. If you look at something, a lot of times it's much easier to digest when it says, this is it. And it also should improve the predictability and outcome. This is what we intend to get at, not just by series of prohibitions, whatever you navigate your way to. This should help explain the intended outcome of what these products look like. It's also going to help inform the codes and the particular elements of the code, how it influences it. So if you have a height restriction, you're going to be able to see in the prototype what that does. Whether they go up or down, it's going to see what does the product look like. The number of parking spaces, you're going to be able to see in a prototype what is the number of parking spaces per unit due to these things. It helps us realize what the influence of the particular elements of the code do to the end product. So that's really kind of the basis of the middle code. I wanted to turn some attention and give some special attention to House Bill 2001. Really, this was introduced in the legislature last year, or approved by the legislature and introduced by the House Speaker, which has some pretty sweeping changes by the way of conventional zoning. So The one that is probably most influential or will be most influential on the city is the code for medium-sized cities. This is going to be state mandated regulations for cities between 10,000 and 25,000 people. It's going to have a requirement or has a requirement that you will allow duplexes, which is a form of middle housing, in all zones that allow single family. So this is essentially, it eliminates the exclusive single family zone. And this is going to happen. This has happened at the statewide level. Currently, Hood River is not at 10,000 in population, so it's not yet a state mandate. But essentially, the urban growth boundary is over 10,000 people at this time. And by way of utilities, the city most likely serves over 10,000 people already because we serve outside the city limits. So really, with no population growth, we are going to but just by geographic growth within the existing urban growth boundary, we will get there.
Dustin?
Yes.
I just wanted to mention that right now in the R1 zone, which is the single family zone, we already in essence do allow duplexes because we allow accessory dwelling units. Granted, they are 800 square feet or less, but we do allow two dwelling units in an R1 zone already. So we're kind of doing this to some extent. It hasn't impacted us in a big negative way. I think we've just been able to get a few more small dwellings for, you know, mother-in-law apartments or something like that. But we are kind of doing this already to some extent.
Yeah, so Senate Bill 1051, which came the year before, required cities to allow accessory dwelling units to all single family. So now within R1, we have to allow an ADU to a single family home. The only difference now is we limit it to 800 square feet to the living area. So this would essentially change that to not have a limit on the second dwelling. You would have two dwelling units and each of them could have greater than 800 square feet at this time. So that would really be the change. The question here becomes, how does the city want to prepare for this? This is a bit of a policy question on whether the city wants to wait until this becomes a mandate and you cross the 10,000 population threshold. Or as we are looking at the middle housing code, is it something that you would like to see included and evaluated through the legislative process? By including it, it doesn't mean that it's approved. Clearly you have to go through the process, but is it something that we should even invest our time in as staff and consulting as we develop these, given that you're close, but it is not a mandate. Once it crosses, you won't have to change the code. You will direct, the state says you will direct apply the state's code. So there's no option.
So Dustin, do you want us to talk about that now, since you're posing the question, or do you want to keep going through your presentation?
I have one more slide and we'll open it up. So, okay. So really back to that, the key changes would be allowing duplexes in R1. And at this point, the state is saying you will only be able to require two, not four, off-street parking spaces for a duplex. So they're not only incentivizing the use by making it allowed, they are limiting the number of off-street parking spaces in the rules as drafted now in that code. Oops. So really kind of going back, what we're looking for is some input from council on the project scope and the approach prior to the launch of the legislative process. We want to make sure that we've heard you correctly, that we have some, that as we go forward with this, that we've taken into account some of your concerns, both for things that you feel like should be included and evaluated, or even things that you want us to be cautious of. And really, we're here to listen. Again, this will go through a legislative approval process that will build some of the framework. It will kick off it with public hearings with Planning Commission, and then it will come to you. But again, we want to make sure that we represent some of the council goals and that we've heard what you expect to be at least evaluated and hope to get out of this. That's all. I'm ready for.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Dustin. Appreciate it. So I think we've got at least two questions, and one was regarding Senate Bill 2001 and incorporating that into the process. And just, and besides that, just general process questions or directions. Does anyone want to kick it off? Mark.
I was hoping to listen to people instead of just blabber, but I'll blabber first. So this is good. So I think it's important to remember that in 2015, in that housing process, we laid out three legs to provide a broad range of housing options. The first one was addressing STRs, and we've done that. The second one was to partner with other entities to build, 80% and below median income housing, and we've attempted to and to date haven't succeeded, but that's still our intention, and the RAND property is the next opportunity for that, I think. And then the third thing was to broaden the number of housing types allowed across the city to allow clever, smart, small footprint homes to the extent possible. So what I see this is proceeding with that third leg of the housing stool. And so I'm sort of excited to see it. It isn't the end all. We still have to talk about how do we incent people to build these clever forms of housing. But having the code allow them seems to me a prerequisite to that. So until we have cottage code, we can't incent people to build cottage code things, right? So same thing with these other small form factor things. So I'm highly supportive of this effort. As far as the 2001, it seems to me that we're frighteningly close to crossing the 10,000 threshold now, or I think we're 1,200, 1,500 people short. We haven't annexed some of the already built up places in the city that we're already providing services to. So to me, that is generally a good idea anyway. So as opposed to going through this whole process and then crossing 10,000 in a year and then having to go through this whole process again doesn't make sense to me. So I'm supportive of taking on the 2001 code requirements now. Looking at the map that Dustin sent out, the amount of R1 that's in infill is dwarfed by the amount of R2 already, and so it just sort of makes that more uniform across the city as far as what housing types are allowed. So this is consistent with what we said. This is prerequisites for incenting housing types that we want, and we may as well bite the bullet and get the 2001 stuff in that will increase our housing stock and do that sooner than later. So that's my put.
Thanks, Mark. And I think the 2001, if we don't do any work on what we want that to look like, if we cross the threshold, I believe we have to just adopt what the state has given us. Is that correct, Dustin?
you have a year from the time that you're certified 10,000, you would have a year to implement your own regulations, or this, you would then be direct applying the state. So within, depending on what you had available and when 10,000, you have a calendar year to work that out according to the existing draft of the administrative rules.
I guess I let's tackle it now, then have to tackle it again later. That's my 2 cents on that. Others? Gladys?
Yeah, I agree. Let's tackle this on now rather than tackling it on later. But I have another question. I read the report from Echo Northwest, and I don't know if they're gonna give us a report now or if it was just part of our packet for us to read. And I started, you know, it talks about the urban growth boundary and how challenging it is to, you know, go down that direction. And I just want to know, I mean, I know why, because of the Columbia Gorge National Scenic Area, but wouldn't we want to start that process too, even if it takes, you know, 3-4 years to complete? I mean, wouldn't we want to start that as well now, knowing it's going to be challenging? I think right now we have to play to our advantage that we're in a situation of COVID, and maybe this is the right time to, I don't know, ask the scenic area, have the support of the governor involved so that we can grow the urban growth boundary.
So
I would probably put that on a next year's project list. That would be, so the scenic area literally would be an act of Congress to allow that to happen. I would estimate that we would measure this in decades time, not years, for the expansion to occur if we wanted to rely on that. So I guess it would be, if you were looking for that to occur within the next decades, we should start that now.
We should start it. We have all this data that tells us how bad our housing situation is here. I think if we pass this on even to like Jeff Merkley, like, hey, look how bad it's getting, come see it, that we can at least make some change, or at least start moving in the direction of change, as opposed to just sitting here and not doing anything at all. And in 10 years, whomever's in this seat now says, oh, maybe now we should start it.
Yeah, the other part would be looking at the high value farmland that's not in the scenic area, which is also not a particularly easy path or option, probably also measured in decades. But again, that if that's something that council wants to pursue, that is a strategy and work plan that we would need some careful project scoping for. That's not something that is just launched without some, I would have to make we would have, that's very ambitious. So I would need you all to be on board with that for probably a protracted amount of time. So.
And I think part of the thing is, Gladys, is that when we did the last housing needs analysis, which was 2015, correct, Dustin?
Yeah.
They stated in that we had enough land for 20 years out from that point. So now we're 5 years down the road. So now we've got 15 years left. And that's if some of the land that's on the west side that's now orchard converts, because it's zoned for residences, but it has orchard on it now. So, you know, you have to prove that you need it. And if you already have enough land that your housing needs analysis says you have enough land, then, you know, they would say, well, you know, you need to wait till you can prove that mm-hmm. you need it. So, you know, there's a whole list of complicated issues. And I'm not saying it can't be done, but like Dustin said, it is literally an act of the federal government to allow it to happen, the act of Congress. It's a big deal.
Yeah, and I understand that. I feel that we should at least talk about starting it.
So my understanding of part of the proving that we need to do it was that we would need to show that we are using the land that we do already have efficiently, and which kind of leads back to this, you know, infill and missing middle housing and you know, development of places that are currently, you know, 10 acre lots or however many acre orchard, but I don't know, to kind of show that it's not that we, this lazy isn't the right word, but it's not that we're going to expand because it's too much work to do the infill and create the city that is kind of designed with an Oregon land use law of being the place where more people should be. So you're not spreading out. We have to kind of do that work before I think we can actually push and say we genuinely need to go out into farmland or into the scenic area or into forest. And I think some of tonight is part of that work that we need to do before we can really, you know, in all honesty, say we've really tried and it's just not enough.
So Dustin, would it be correct to say that in order to actually embark upon that discussion, that we would have to have the proper justification in place, like we're out of land?
Yeah, I mean, I think without presupposing the criteria of an urban area expansion, you would absolutely have to have some sort of narrative that says why is that a last resort? Right. That you have taken the necessary steps to limit the amount of, if you are going for a scenic area or even a high value farmland expansion in the urban growth boundary, that you would there. I would suggest to you that you had a great narrative regarding what efforts were taken before you asked for that.
Right. And I think what Megan just said is that essentially we are starting that process. Gladys, you know, by actually doing these things, we actually have to go, this is part of the steps that we go through to actually get to the urban growth boundary expansion is part. And so it's kind of like a sequential thing where we go through and then we do these things, you know, use the land that we have efficiently. So in essence, I guess we are really starting that. We're just not starting like an application process, if that makes any sense.
Jessica, were you gonna say something?
Yeah, I was just gonna jump back to the you know, the middle housing questions and the House Bill 2001. I do, you know, in my neighborhood we have, I'm mostly R1, but we do have duplexes and we do have apartment buildings, and I feel like that a duplex can blend in with detached single family dwellings. So I would, like some of the other counselors have expressed, I would I would support moving forward with incorporating the House Bill 2001 changes. One thing that I would be interested to see, this is kind of a question for Dustin or maybe like a policy, is there any way to discourage teardowns? You know, that's one of my concerns. I'm excited about having a diversity of housing options for developers anywhere in the city, because I do think that having these smaller options is our best way to really diversify the neighborhoods that we have here. How do we get more, you know, starter families? How do we get the income and the age and the, you know, the racial diversity that I think we all want to see? I think that having this diverse housing stock available all over the city is going to be the best way, one of the best ways that we can do it. And Mark's comments about incentives, yes, I also want to see what can we do to incentivize, but then how can we decentivize, I guess? Well, I don't know. It's kind of a, like, I want to see more diverse housing, but I also don't necessarily want to see, you know, these teardowns of, you know, smaller, older things for, you know, something that's, you know, gigantic and doesn't fit in with the scale of the neighborhood. I don't know if there's an answer for that, but that's just something that I'm thinking about.
So is that the demo question or more of what is it replaced with? Just to, so I can, so is it? Is
I don't
it,
know.
Okay. No. Jessica, would it be like you want to see it as infill versus tear down and replace is like,
yeah,
the direction of how you would want that land used?
Mm-hmm.
Or I don't know if that helps, Dustin, but.
Yeah, I've seen both things happen in my personal neighborhood. And, you know, sometimes it's like, well, there's no way I can get another unit on there if I leave on there what's there. And it's so old and it's so inefficient for use of electricity and, you know, insulation, everything. And so they just tear it down and then they do build two because I live in an R2 zone. You know, something more modern, but maybe not necessarily bigger, but then sometimes absolutely, yes, bigger. They'll tear down two and they'll build three and they are all pretty big, or you'll be one or two that are kind of medium sized and one that's big. But I've seen all of it. I've seen some of them add on a new modern house with an older house and it looks like, oh man, what was that? Because it doesn't really go with what was there before. So, I mean, I've seen, you know, you get everything. I don't know how we could really control that. That'd be hard. Megan?
Yeah, so I think I'm just going to say my thoughts on the high level of this. I really want the city to have through all of its neighborhoods, the diversity of ages, the diversity of family sizes, the diversity of incomes, diversity of pretty much everything. And I think in order to get that, we need to have the full range of diversity of housing types and housing sizes and housing mixes. And so I'm super supportive of looking at all of the different potential middle products that could be developed. I think the House Bill 2001 is one part of that mix, since it is part of the missing middle housing types. So I'm certainly supportive of looking at that as we're looking at all of these together, versus waiting a year or two or however long it takes. I think part of, you know, the struggle we've been seeing, or I've certainly been seeing in town, is that we are only getting really one dominant housing type, which tends to be large, tends to be expensive, and really limits who can afford to buy those houses or rent those houses and therefore live in town. And so I think I want the full range available in town, but I clearly my interest would be in seeing that we increase the supply of smaller and medium-sized houses instead of more large ones. And in general, we clearly need to increase supply because no one can afford to come into this town, or anyone who's here can't afford to stay. So I'd like to see that looked at. And I think we need to, yeah, you know, use all the land we have and make sure that we're looking at all of it.
Thanks, Megan. I think this look at all the middle housing and the House Bill 2001, are great start, and I think it will help if everything isn't done through a PUD or conditional use permit, because if we make it more simple for developers to be able to do these kinds of things and we have our parameters on them, so it's not, you know, arbitrary or doesn't have to go to planning commission, that it'll be easier for developers to do these things, and hopefully we will start to see some different things. It's not incentives, but at least it would make the process easier. So I'm all for going ahead with this. It's Eric.
Sure, Mayor. I'm happy to provide some thoughts. My personal perspective currently is that I'm wanting to perhaps do more listening than talking. And I say that because I really have an open mind in all this, and some of this is new to me. But I have some comments as it relates to the cottage and cluster, and then I'll separately address the House bill. 2001. So as to the cottage and cluster, I agree. If we can create a sort of template that the developers can follow and not have to go through the PUD process, that would be more efficient. I would be wanting to be mindful of making sure whatever's developed maintains some sense of open space, because that seems to be part of our community fabric. In other words, not to be mindful of cottage not becoming too dense, but nonetheless to consider that. And you know, where do we put it? Is it R2 and R3, or is it also an R1? I'm not sure. That's probably something that needs to be discussed. But I'm in favor of this cottage cluster, kind of creating a template to allow these to go forward more efficiently. As to House Bill 2001, you know, I really do keep an open mind. As I sit here today, I reflect a minority view on council. You know, that bill was controversial. It did not enjoy unanimous support. I mean, what bill does, but the Oregon League of Cities, for example, was opposed to it. And I guess my concerns about it substantively are just worrying about unintended consequences. Because if we essentially get rid of R1, we are in a way, at least in some significant respects, making every R1 lot now a developable lot. And what could that do? Well, that could actually increase the value of those lots. To build what? Well, what's going in a lot lately seems to be these big townhomes that tend to be high-priced vacation homes, not what we're actually driving for. So I'm just one, and you know, the other externalities could be parking. If we now have twice as many homes, and I realize it wouldn't be now, it'd be over years and decades, but there could be parking congestion, and it just could potentially disrupt our current sense of community. So densification, you know, as this process goes through, be thinking about, well, are we going to maintain certain lot to building size ratios to make sure it's just not all suddenly buildings everywhere and no place for nature in a sense of outdoors and in our backyards and our community. And you know, the advantage of the ADUs the mayor referenced, and I think that was a fair reference, those are smaller. It's not quite the same as saying now we can, as you know, Councillor Meadow was concerned about the teardown, so we're going to start tearing down our R1s and replacing with two big condos. It's a concern. And where do we put should we allow this throughout all zoning? Should it maybe just be R2? Do we actually want to be careful than allowing it in R3 because we have such precious R3, we don't want necessarily to get consumed up. Maybe we want to make sure R3 is used for apartment houses. So these are all more questions and statements. Again, I'm more in listening mode, but I'm cautious about House Bill 2001 adoption, thinking maybe we'll let that play out, see how other communities deal with it first, but I keep an open mind, but I'm in favor of the cottage and cluster concept.
Thank you, Eric. On the House Bill 2001, if we go through that process now and put our parameters on it that we would like to see, is there, you know, we have a limitation on the ADU size. Can we have a limitation on second units, you know, turning a single family use into a duplex and putting a size limitation? Dustin, do you have any?
It has to be clear and objective standards. What I'll do is, as we get into it, I'll look into the draft language now and see if there's, I'm not sure if you could separate the requirements from a single family versus a duplex. But if you have the same standard, same lot coverage, same height restriction, I think that's how you would probably have to position it, to say, you can cover 45% of the lot, whether it's a single family or two family home, the same height restriction. So you probably have to have some parity between the single family as well as the duplex. So I'll look into that and investigate how does that come out in the draft. And we'll be able to kind of vet that with what the state believes it's done to this point. So again, it's not even in law yet. So we're trying to anticipate some of the things that are coming out of it based on the draft, the rulemaking advisory committee. So it's coming. They want comments. It's happening now. I'm I'll look into how did the some of the nuances come out.
Okay, thanks. So I guess I just want to repeat, hopefully I'm getting what you said there. So for instance, if we have an R1 now, and you can cover 45% of the lot, and just say you're 28 feet high is the most you could go, potentially depending on how big that lot was, you could have a 6,000 square foot home. But if you did a duplex, you could have a 5,000 square foot home and a 1,000 square foot home, or you could have a two 3,000 square foot homes. Is that, am I correct in?
Yeah, that would be, I think that would be a fair assumption.
Assessment, okay, yeah. All right. Just so I could keep in my mind, you can't cover more of the lot and you can't go higher than you normally could with a single family. Okay, thanks.
Unless we permitted it.
Unless you permitted it, yeah.
Unless that would be explicit in some of the sidebars that we would definitely need to have in the rules of these are the clear and objective standards that you will operate under, so.
Okay. Additional, Tim?
So Dustin, you know, I think what I'm hearing you saying is that this is kind of like a necessary first step of, you know, getting towards the middle housing part of this. And then I heard various discussions about incentivizing and other things we might do to actually kind of steer the middle housing concept. So what, you know, assuming that we go through this and proceed through it and it goes through the legislative process and comes out the other end, you know, what is your impression or thoughts on the next steps that we would take to kind of steer the middle housing
discussion? Yeah. I mean, after this,
yes.
What comes next?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Do I get the pick? No. No. It's really, to me, I think one of the things that was identified in the buildable, so I'd go back to the buildable lands inventory. Mm-hmm. I think some of the things that we would circle back to, and some of the many would be the scarcity of R3, as mentioned, is something, and that is something that is very limited, and we would want to look at how does that work into the future. The other piece would be your commercial zones, which currently allow for mixed-use housing, are something that the buildable lands inventory said you will have to rely upon the use of those commercially zoned properties to make way for enough your future demand for housing type in that category. Those would be two things that I would definitely target. And then we have the various code cleanup of just things, the legacy of the code, the legacy of the rules that we work under, some of the permitted enhancement projects that we're working on now, which are not necessarily codified, but the manner in which we approve things and some of our business practices. I think those are all really important things that may not be as glamorous, but they have some very important implications on how we move things. And then also you have capital improvements projects or capital facilities plans in place. Those aren't necessarily zoning code matters, but they certainly have influence on the infrastructure and the cost, the land basis that Echo Northwest talks about in some of that. And those aren't purely zoning code matters, but those are very influential when it comes to driving demand and accommodating some of that infrastructure that's necessary for housing, both in by way of quality of life and amenities, as well as just basic functions. So I think that's the top off the top of my head, what I would look at. That'll keep us busy for a while.
Yep. Thank you.
Did Mark, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I just had a question. All along I've thought that the incentives, both carrots and sticks, would come after this, but is that a true statement? Is that something for the next goal setting to look at, or where does that fit in?
I think one of the, you know, it's both. The answer is both. I mean, the idea that you have a that this housing product right now needs to be approved by way of discretionary approval in public hearing, and a conditional use approval is a disincentive. So refining some of the sidebars and standards that apply to them rather than reinvent it every time in a plan unit development process, that in itself is an incentive to the development community. If you have any, you know, anytime there's a development community, they're gonna say process predictability is a non-cash incentive that means the world to them. So that in itself, having a code that's specifically tailored to the product rather than an more discretionary and more open-ended process is an incentive. But I think I heard, and rightly so, before you start building incentives into something, you have to allow it. I mean, so the first incentive is to make it allowable. The second incentive would be to, under how do you incentivize this product in other ways? I mentioned and I heard in there also smaller, you know, the smaller housing becomes something. You can also build into the code as you refine it, things that become advantageous for smaller units. If you want to incentivize a smaller unit, you maybe make it easier to permit, or maybe you provide some competitive advantages for a house that is 1,000 square feet versus a 3,500 square foot townhouse. I mean, I'm hearing that is one of your goals. And so when I start looking at these rules and regs, that will be in my mind of how do we accomplish that, or how do we not disincentivize those things? I mean, it's to the contrary, it's how do you make we could build in the disincentives too of unintentionally if we don't know what the goal is. So this is exactly what I was hoping for is, you know, I hear the concerns, I hear the ideas of open space, of amenities, I hear the idea of smaller, more diverse products, widespread. These are the type of things that I'm gonna need to knit with a consultant and start bringing forward as we move this into the public process, some of the goals and aspirations and cautions that you're sharing. This is exactly what I need.
And does this work plan also address whatever we're doing wrong in C2 or R3 that's making multifamily not pencil, or is that a different thing?
I think that'll be a different one. That'll probably be what's next, because if we start getting too broad there, you know, we're talking about neighborhood scale product type. It's a little more narrow. The C2 is actually more on the other side of things. You know, the C2 doesn't have a maximum density. C2 has a minimum density. So we're now starting to talk about not something that is more middle housing. We're starting to shift to the other side of middle. So I think that's probably better served as a discrete, more of a discrete conversation.
Okay. You know, we just keep waiting for it to pencil in the market to build those housing types, and it's not happening. So I understand if it's next, that's grand. Okay.
Yeah, and I think some of it is, you know, we talked about C2, a little bit of what we did with the, you know, downtown is all C2. So one of the small steps that you took is to initiate some of the legislative work to support the retrofit of residential downtown. That's a subtle thing, but it's also, you know, I wouldn't expect one solution to address this. I expect a lot of solutions that are going to be needed to start addressing this, big and small.
Additional discussion? Okay, great. Looking forward to getting started on it. That's fantastic. See where we are here. Okay, we're gonna adjourn the work session and we're gonna open the regular council meeting at 7:29. Additions or corrections?
Oh, we have none, Mayor.
Okay, great. We've got quite a few things on consent agenda. I'm just going to read off what those are and see if anyone has anything they want to pull off or a question on anything. Meeting minutes. capital project management consulting contract, Microsoft Office 365 licensing and migration, amendment number 2 to the strategic communications assistance professional services agreement with PageWorks, and OLCC permit application for the Downwinder and for Votum Restaurant.
Madam Mayor?
Uh-huh.
On that one, and maybe this is in the nature of just requesting an amendment, but I think the consent agenda lists the address for the Votum Restaurant on 13th Street, which wouldn't be the right zoning. I think that's probably the home address of the applicant and not the business address. So we should just make sure that's clarified correctly.
Okay.
They are on 2nd Street for the business.
2nd Street. Okay. I'll make a note that the Votum Restaurant is on 2nd Street for the consent agenda. Anything else? Okay, could we get a motion for the consent agenda?
Move that we accept the consent agenda with the note Eric just had.
I have a motion to approve.
Second.
I've got 3 people seconding. Tim, okay, Tim seconded. additional discussion? Roll call vote. Megan?
Yes.
Mark?
Yes.
Jessica?
Aye.
Tim?
Aye.
Gladys?
Yes.
Eric?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. The consent agenda is approved. We have a couple regular business items. The DKS contract approval for transportation system plan amendment. Dustin? You're on again.
All right, no presentation for this one. Thank you, Mayor. This is a continuation of your discussion from before, and included in your packet is the scope that we discussed, as well as a previous memo prepared by DKS regarding some of the Planning Commission recommendations. We had discussion last time about what were the recommendations included and what was kind of supported to be included in the narrow scope of the TSP update amendment for 2011 and what we recommended and what the consultant recommended be deferred. So in your packet, it talks about one of the recommendations was the advisory shoulder. And this is they dub it experimental technology, not quite tested. So the recommendation from the consultant was if you wanted to invest your time in looking at this, they would recommend more that would be better suited to a full-scale TSP revision rather than trying to do a narrow tailored update to your existing TSP and include it. The other item that we talked about in some detail was in related to task 2. Task 2 had a bullet list regarding an intersection investigation that we felt was going to be necessary. This is the intersection of Wine Country and Country Club Road, or Wine Country and Mount Adams. It's not the Cascade intersection. It's actually the right-hand turn that you all take now if you head towards Country Club Road and route to Post Canyon. So within that bullet list, we had a punch list of the items that would be included in this investigation. I had misspoke at the last meeting that we were talking about one of them. This is actually all 4 of these components are included in that one investigation. So we have one transportation model. These would be the variables that we would have to test to make sure that the model still works, or to understand the consequences of changing this one intersection to a different configuration. So would it result in traffic diverting from the expected areas, or traffic moving in directions that we didn't anticipate, or leading to some other problems? So that is one area that we wanted to be tested in this model, and DKS was willing to rerun some of the model and assumptions so that we understood if we made changes to this intersection, before it's included in the TSP, that we would understand the consequences and be able to choose what route we wanted to go. So with that, that's really the update for this matter. The same recommendation and request from council is there.
Okay, thanks, Dustin, for the update on that. Council, questions? Mark?
So, and I didn't do my homework to remember what, there were things that the draft last time took out that Planning Commission had recommended. And you were to look at those and see, and that's in the task one section, is that true? I'm being rusty.
Was that the advisory shoulder that Dustin just talked about?
Yeah, I included the memo from, I believe it's December 2019, of all the planning, it was the consultant's review on the Planning Commission recommendations. And the only one that came out of, that was removed from that into this scope was the advisory shoulder. So that's why it's the one recommendation from Planning Commission that has not been considered.
And where is that in this document? That's underneath task one?
No.
Or it's just gone?
It's gone. It's just gone altogether.
And what is an advisory shoulder?
I will go to, so actually on, you can go to and refer to page 80 of your packet. So it's a shared use to where all users, like a bicycle user, a ped, and a motor vehicle would share the lane, and the car, essentially, the motor vehicle would be forced to yield to the bicycle. So this is really the last, the discussion occurs in the last bullet.
Gotcha.
Justin, was this, when we talked about that framework, was that the one where it was like a single drive lane with two dotted lines on each side?
Yes.
Okay.
If we're talking, I'm assuming yes. So that's my recollection as well.
That description wasn't good enough.
That appears to be the description. So it's really kind of a blend between a local street and a collector's or a collector street, to where we have a forced yield and kind of a little more a space where, rather than a separation of bikes use this portion, the cars use this portion, it's really more of a, it's a little more of a blended mode. The intent is to require, again, a bike priority in this blended space. Again, it is on par with an experimental street type. And so again, that's part of the reason why it's pulled from here, is because it just, if you want to use some experimental technologies, it's going to require a little more rigorous process to test this.
So taking it out of the TSP work, and then if we're really hip to it, we pick a street and we try it, kind of thing. Is that the
that is one kind of the tactical, that would be the tactical urbanism, to do a pilot project, that it wouldn't just be in the canon of permissible streets, that you would try it somewhere. The other option would be when you get into a TSP, a full-blown amendment, where you start really opening up this thing to, you know, in its broadest capacity, you start building into that process.
I understand what we did, and I'm hip to where we're going. So that's.
We could at some time in the future, though. Are you saying, Dustin, that we could, you know, we get 5 years down the road, we aren't ready for the full-blown TSP, we have a piece of property that's several, you know, acres, and it's ripe for this size of a street, we could apply to do a pilot project at that point that would incorporate this potentially. Is that possible?
Yeah, that's possible. And there's also, you have a circumstance and a development that that warrants it. You know, it's not the easiest way, but you do have a design exception available for the city engineer to evaluate what would be an appropriate street type. So that would be more of an immediate application on, you know, again, not open to everyone, but an evaluation of that street type based on the circumstance. If we got a request to do that and we were able to evaluate it, we would be able to put it in context of a development and of a location and really under the microscope for that particular application. And we could do it there as well. That's always a possibility.
Okay, thanks. Additional questions?
Justin, I think we had talked about this last meeting and I just forget, but the scope of work has a budget of a little less than 59,000 and the resolution has a not to exceed of 69,000. Is that on purpose to give a buffer? Justin, you're on mute.
No, the 69 is a wrong number. So that was, we had to reconcile that to 59.
Okay.
More questions?
I would be willing to make a motion to approve the resolution with the correct amount and the work scope to DKS and Associates to amend the city's transportation system plan.
Have a motion?
I'll second.
And a second by Megan. Additional discussion? All right, roll call vote. Eric?
Aye.
Gladys?
Yes.
Megan?
Yes.
Mark?
Yes.
Tim?
Aye.
Jessica?
Aye.
And chair votes aye. All right, we're ready to get started on that one. Thank you, Dustin.
Thank you all.
Thank you for the additional information so we could all get into the details of this stuff ahead of time a little bit, because there's just so much there on these things. Thank you. Let's see, where are we? Resolution establishing a PERS site account under the State of Oregon's Employer Incentive Fund. Will.
Thank you, Mayor, members of City Council. This is a follow-on item from a discussion that we started back in October 28th of 2019, when we when staff presented on the Employer Incentive Fund that the State of Oregon created to incentivize local governments to create a PERS site account, essentially pre-funding their retirement liabilities by providing a 25% state match to any deposits into this investment account. At that time, the City Council approved applying for the full match available to us, which is the city depositing $1,638,737.60 in order to get a 25% match of $409,684.40 from the state for a total site account held in the city's name of $2 million. And that $2 million would be invested in all the same securities that the PERS fund is invested in, but the earnings on this money would go solely to the benefit of the city over the next 20 years. So with that direction, we applied knowing that we would be able to decide later what the final deposit amount that we're going to do is. When the application period opened up, was able to get our application in within the first 5 minutes, and after 10 minutes it was closed and people were on the wait list. When you have 25% match of free money, a lot of people jump in there. So we were able to hold our place and secure that money. And now is the time to decide what is the final amount that we want to deposit all the way up to the maximum amount. Our scheduled date is July 20th, although because of COVID-19 uncertainty, the state legislature did push back the deadline to December. So we could move this back to December 1st if we wanted to. Why that is risky and not what I would recommend to you is that the Oregon legislature is planning a special session, and they have cut targets amongst all of the agencies of 8%. So they want to see 8% reductions. And so if this money is not tied up into our site account, it could very well be on the chopping block for getting clawed back through a supplemental budget midway through the state's biennium. As far as the, so that's sort of the time critical piece as to when to make the deposit. As far as the amount of the deposit, still recommending the full amount, even with the COVID-19 revenue uncertainty. Looking at revenues, how we're trending towards the end of the fiscal year, there's still a lot of year-end transactions, but it's looking like we are trending towards exactly what's in the budget. So carrying forward about $3.5 million into next year. Don't hold me to that at this point, but I'm just telling you that's where we're trending right now. And the fiscal year 2021 budget includes as a financial plan the full payment of this PERS site account distributed proportionally across all the operating funds that will benefit from having lower PERS costs going forward. And so I still see that as the 2021 budget is still holds as our best understanding of a financial plan for the city in the next year. And with that, I'll answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, Will. Questions for Will on this? Looks pretty self-explanatory. Megan, did you have a question?
Not a question, but I did just want to thank Will again for making it into that first 10 minutes of getting this. And on my end, it seems like the most fiscally responsible thing we can do is to invest in this if we've got the money, and Will has made sure that we do. So
there's high excitement as it gets in public finance.
It's very fun for me.
Spinning that lottery wheel in the first 5 minutes to see if you can get your marble to drop in the right spot. Oh man. Okay. If we don't have any additional questions, there's a motion on page 83 regarding this.
So I move we adopt resolution 2020-12 directing the establishment of a PERS site account under the State of Oregon Employer Incentive Fund Program.
Do we need to state the amount, Will, or not?
It's in the resolution.
Okay, all right.
I second that.
Gladys has seconded that. Megan made the motion. Additional discussion? Roll call vote. Gladys?
Yes.
Jessica?
Aye.
Mark?
Yes.
Tim?
Aye.
Megan?
Yes.
Eric?
Aye.
And chair votes aye. All right. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great.
Report of officers.
Mayor, I know that both Will and Dan have reports to make. So Will, why don't you go ahead?
Okay, yes, three quick things to update the council on. One, the first one, the biggest one, is that we have a framework for the remaining amount of the coronavirus relief funds. So our initial application of about $50,000 was approved. The money is in hand. We have that deposited. So that reimbursed us for expenses through March. The League of Oregon Cities with the Special Districts Association of Oregon and the Association of Oregon Counties came together with a framework of how to distribute the rest of it that the governor's office has generally signed on to, as I understand it. I don't think anything's been signed as far as an agreement, but the framework exists and it's on paper. And the city of Hood River's allocation is $244,000 additional dollars in addition to what has already been reimbursed to us. So I'm going to, you know, we brought forward to you a few meetings ago a framework to do an economic incentive or an economic redevelopment program. So we're going to, in light of these monies and the Treasury guidance, reconfigure that and bring it back to you with a little bit more discrete proposals, hopefully by the next meeting. And we're expecting, you know, to have some nonprofit assistance, small business assistance, and individual assistance would be the three legs of the stool. And then also set aside a little bit more money for the city's direct expenses responding to COVID, as well as a reimbursement program for anyone who has had to do major outlays in order to reconfigure their business for COVID. And so this could be also a place where we'll recommend creating a grant program for people who spent money on parklets and are now needing to have them removed by ODOT. So I think it's going to be mostly allocatable for programs like this. 90% of the financial detriment to the city from COVID-19 has been in revenue loss. Really hasn't, didn't, but that's not what this money can be used for. So we're going to put it to the best and highest use possible.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And if anyone has input on that as well, feel free to contact me directly for ideas. If there's some non-starters or must-haves. Also wanted to give a heads up that it's been on the staff work line for quite a bit to do a cleanup of our transient lodging tax code. We brought draft language to you, I think, over a year and a half ago now, and I had some problems with it, and then other things got priority. But I'm going to hopefully bring that back to you soon, just doing some house cleaning items, and then the major focus on is getting booking intermediaries to remit tax on behalf of their properties. So VRBO HomeAway already does this voluntarily. Airbnb has drawn a line in the sand and said without municipal code saying that we must remit, we are not gonna remit. But I've been in discussions with them over the past couple weeks, and we've come to some language that they agree gives them the necessary authorization for them to start collecting for properties. So I think that's just a good business operations type item, but you know that always it always stirs the pot a bit. So I wanted to give you a heads up on that, and I'll be sending you kind of a bit of a summary and talking points as I send it out for public comment. And then just thirdly, you know that also we may have a fourth contract amendment coming to you. That's the electric vehicle car share that was going to be placed at the city. We're having problems. The wiring infrastructure in City Hall is too antiquated to provide a separate meter for them. So if we want to move forward, we need to do some sort of billing arrangement where the money passes through and then we get reimbursement from them rather than them setting up their own Pacific Power account. Anyway, details on that are forthcoming. I just wanted to give you a heads up. That's all I have.
Thank you. Did someone else have another department head have something?
Madam Mayor, this is Dan. I do. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Okay. I do have a bit of news on the legal front. We got a decision from LUBA last Thursday on the city's decision to rezone a portion of Morrison Park. And especially for those of you who haven't been around for the past 3.5 years, that's when this started. Let me give a little bit of background. I think the first decision the city council made was back in May of 2017 to rezone all of Morrison Park, and this was to accommodate an affordable housing project that would be in collaboration with Big Columbia Housing Authority. It would qualify under the definition of affordable housing. I think 80% or better of the area median income. And that was appealed by Susan Crowley to Luba. Luba affirmed your decision, and then she took it to the Court of Appeals, who reversed and remanded to the City Council on remand. And at that point, you sort of shrunk the rezone to just a portion of Morrison Park, 2.7 acres. The issue on remand involved the interpretation of a single comprehensive plan provision that said existing park sites will be protected from incompatible uses. And with you interpret that.
Dan, you're cutting out.
And you rezoned the property, and Susan Crowley appealed it again to Luba. So in that appeal, Luba has finally affirmed the city's. Can you hear me?
You're cutting in and out.
Okay. So I've got video turned off. Let's see. I don't know how to make this.
Right now, we're getting. It's about 100%. You're great right now, but I think we missed maybe 10% of that last little part you were talking about.
Maybe that can do.
Can't hear you again. Nothing. Could you call? Maybe you could call in. I can give you a phone number to call in.
Okay.
Yeah, let me give you a, let me see if you can hear this. You can try to call us back. 929-205-6099. Still not getting anything.
Jonathan, could you help with this?
I've sent him the meeting.
Okay.
Hopefully that works when he calls in with the cell phone and types in that meeting ID. I unfortunately do not know what cell phone number to look for.
I see it. I think I can do it.
Absolutely. There we go. Thank you.
Dan, is that you?
How about now? Yes. Can you hear me now?
Much better.
Yes.
Okay. Anyhow, let me start from the beginning. This involves the City Council's decision to rezone Morrison Park for a affordable housing project. Originally, it was going to be in collaboration with the Mid-Columbia Housing Authority. And the original decision that the City Council made was back in May of 2017. So it's been in process for a long time. As you know, Mid-Columbia Housing Authority has, as of the last I've heard, pulled out of the project, and it has proceeded strictly on the city's decision to rezone a portion of Morrison Park. The first time around, this was appealed by Susan Crowley, a citizen neighbor to the park, and Luba affirmed the city, but the Court of Appeals reversed and remanded, came back for further interpretation by the City Council of a single comprehensive plan policy that required existing park sites will be protected from incompatible uses. So based on that comp plan provision, the city council rezoned only a portion of the park last time around, 2.76 acres of it. And Ms. Crowley appealed that to LUBA. And last Thursday, LUBA issued this decision affirming the city council's interpretation. So the reason why this is important may not be so much that there's a live project to work on with the Mid-Columbia Housing Authority, although that may eventually happen, but rather to affirm that the city council has the authority to rezone its park sites or portions of park sites that it wishes to put to non-park uses. So that's basically what this decision stands for. There's a 21-day appeal period to the Court of Appeals. I tend to expect that Ms. Crowley will file one, so this show ain't over yet. But at this point, the city council has been affirmed by LUBA. Any questions? Have people seen this opinion? I can push it out to all of you.
Yeah, I'd like to see it. If you could push it out, that'd be great.
Sure. Okay, anything else on this one?
I'm trying to see if anyone's hands are up. Any questions? No, I guess no questions. Thank you, Dan, appreciate it.
Okay, I'll get a copy of this out to all of you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Additional department heads? Anything else? Either of the chiefs have anything for us?
I don't, Mayor, thank you.
Nothing from the police department.
Okay. And Wade, did you have anything?
No, I don't have anything either. Thank you.
Okay, great. All right. So we've got mayor call and council call. Let's just talk about parklets first, since we had a couple people who've been diligently waiting to hear what we're going to talk about on our call this whole time. So let's just talk about those, and then I'll go over my other things. So, Rachel, maybe you sent some information out about where we were with that and kind of what happened on that, but maybe you could refresh us on what's happening on the parklets.
Sure. Mayor, Council, I'm happy to. First, let me say that we agree with much of what was expressed regarding the importance of keeping the parklets and the frustration with not being able to work through this with ODOT. As you know, we communicated the program and our intentions to ODOT, and they signaled support, which we relied on, I think reasonably, especially under the circumstances and with the public health directives to move forward. So we are working through options right now to maintain outdoor seating in support of businesses and public health. You've heard some opinions about what some, you know, what that means to the businesses. But happy to, you know, suggest some options for city council if you're looking for some, or address any other questions.
Jessica?
So Rachel's original email about this reference that there were three businesses impacted, and of course the third is the one that my husband and his partners own. Slopeswell has, they put a parklet on 12th just about a week ago. And so I'm definitely really interested in this topic, and I know the city has been working really hard to push back against ODOT. And I had expressed to Rachel is, you know, I feel like this is just another example of ODOT telling us what to do, and all we can do is wring our hands. And I'm so tired of that. You know, the solution that ODOT had come up with to have, you know, the tables on a sidewalk and have ramps where the pedestrians are going into the street is just, I feel like it's laughable. I don't know if it's like, you know, do we get the Oregonian? Do we get OPB? Do we get, you know, who do we get involved to say, ODOT, this doesn't even make sense, you know? It's And it's not a solution. I mean, as we've heard, it's not really a solution for 64 ounce or for Andrews. It's not a solution for Slopeswell. So anyway, those are, I'm happy to help, you know, whatever. I don't know what it is besides wringing my hands and talking about how mad I am, but I'm happy to do some legwork.
Megan?
Yeah, if Rachel has ideas of what council can do to try and rectify this situation, I am definitely on board. You know, if we need to bug the governor or the legislature, or, you know, I guess I don't quite know what the roadblock is that means putting pedestrians closer to the traffic but not having the same parking spaces used for seating. One is okay and one is not. Just doesn't make sense to me, but I'm with Jessica. I feel like every couple of months we, you know, whether it's Rand and Cascade or Second and Oak or this or something else, of incredibly frustrating to not have say in our own community and some of our main roads and business districts. And certainly given COVID and the pandemic and the impacts on businesses, it just feels so painful right now to have done one of the few silver linings of this whole event has been these parklets that I, you know, maybe the first time ever have only ever heard positive things about in this community, and to then have that feel like it's basically ripped away, I think is a huge loss to the community and is clearly very painful for those individual businesses. So I'm very interested in hearing what Rachel thinks we could do or what council would like to do to try and make this better.
Yeah, I agree with both of you. You know, it's kind of like, what is the chain of command? Is ODOT their own chain? Is there no chain above them? Is it the legislature that makes the rules that tells them? I don't know what the chain of command is, because we certainly are hitting our head against a brick wall with this in the middle of a pandemic. It's just crazy, completely crazy. Eric?
Yeah, I very much share the frustrations that have been expressed here in the beginning of the meeting. And what strikes me, what is particularly bothersome, is I was part of this ACT committee meeting with ODOT. And the last time we had a meeting, Ryan Wersheimer, who's the head of Region 1, one of the first things out of his mouth, and I felt like he was directing this comment to me, was how, he didn't use the word progressive, but how, you know, progressive the city of Hood River had been in terms of getting out in front of this. And he was looking forward to review our application, and it was all roses from him. We were led to believe this would be approved. I even talked it up among business people at the Rotary meeting, and it's embarrassing and it's devastating. So, you know, it is frustrating. And one of the questions I had is, what remedy does ODOT actually have? Because should we be evaluating what the remedy is and evaluating that in a risk calculus to proceed? I don't know, maybe that's bluster for me, but it's very frustrating to have been led down this primrose path to now be having to answer to our community members for what is clearly not acceptable. And I guess part of, I also just am wondering, how do we, I don't know if anyone can speak to this, but how did we get here? Because I myself had this discussion with Ryan Wersheimer, and he seemed to be all roses, and something changed. I'm just not sure how it changed.
Mark?
Yeah, this just burns my toast. I think, you know, Rachel and staff, nothing bad to say. I think that, you know, we went into it and staff found a creative solution, and you know, council was 100% behind it. And then for this kind of shenanigans to go on, I guess my question is, and maybe it's sort of along the lines of what Eric just asked, which is it something that we can get Dan involved in? Should we have a special meeting where the director of ODOT State tells us why routing pedestrians in the road is better than having these things that are exactly the size of a car? I don't... I don't want to give up, I guess. If we can, you know, file some legal thing to say we want to, you had given us heads up and we shouldn't yank them out tomorrow. We should wait until after this goes through, whatever. There must be an appeals process in ODOT. So I guess I'm encouraging us to not say, well, okay, we're just lost again to this capricious organization in Salem, to see what we can to fight it as hard as we can. So, but that said, I don't know what that means, but we should.
I don't know what that means either. I don't know what, you know, how much it might cost us or what the procedure might be, but I think we should at least investigate what that could be, because it's just, it's, you know, this is going to continue on. I mean, we've gone back to gatherings of 10 people as of Wednesday. You know, we might go back to phase one in another month or something. So these are really important to be able to have these if we possibly can. So I don't know what the process would be for that. Rachel, do you have any ideas?
Sure. Yeah, happy to. Mayor and Council, well, first, thank you very much for that crystal clear direction. That's always helpful to us. I think, you know, you've sort of highlighted this issue that, and one of the individuals on the phone did, that this will keep coming up. Especially in our downtown. So one thought, and again, this we would need to evaluate the trade-offs, but one thought would be to potentially look at an IGA for a jurisdictional transfer of Oak Street from 5th to Front Street. Now, again, we'd need to go in eyes wide open on what that means, but that is something that I could broach with ODOT. How quickly we could do that, you know, I don't know, but I'd be happy to have that conversation. The other options, we'd be happy to put together a letter for the mayor to sign, expressing, you know, the dismay with this proposed solution. It truly is, and you know, again, ODOT has been trying to figure something out, but the solution is that restaurants would use the seating on the sidewalk and that the pedestrians would be routed into the parking spaces. That is the solution. You've all seen those at construction zones, but that is the proposed solution. So we could write a letter pushing back on that, we could involve some other individuals. We've already involved regional solutions, but I think the ask would be ask them to reconsider given the public health emergency that we're under. So if that's something council's interested in, you just direct staff to do that and we'll work with the mayor to get that off tomorrow. And again, happy to work through a potential jurisdictional transfer as well.
Jessica?
Can we tell ODOT that we're not going to move the parklets tomorrow, or is that like setting off a nuclear bomb?
We are still working with ODOT, so we are not required. We're working with ODOT on a permit for this other solution that they've offered. So it is our understanding that we're supposed to talk to them again tomorrow. Not move them by 6 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Megan?
Wade or Dustin, please jump in if I'm incorrect.
So Rachel, is this happening in other cities or is this something unique to us?
This is unique to us because, I know Ashland, for example, they have a state highway going right through them. They've decided with ODOT support to close one entire lane of parking spaces and to route pedestrians through the parking spaces and allow restaurants to operate on the sidewalk.
Is that something we should be talking about here?
That is what they are talking about allowing us to do, which isn't
Well, I guess I was picturing like, okay, in front of Andrews, it's two spaces. And so it would just be routing for those two spaces. And then, you know, so he basically doesn't have any, it's right in front of his door. Couldn't actually put any tables, but if it's the entire sidewalk and individual businesses can kind of spread beyond their frontage, that is a different setup.
I think it could be either, but I'd look to Dustin and Wade to jump in there.
Yes, so we should receive tomorrow would allow us to close both lanes from Fifth to Front, both parking lanes. We didn't intend to enclose both lanes. We would just plan on closing on an as permitted, you know, as people apply, we would close two spaces in front of them. But we would be allowed by permit to close as many parking as we wanted to on Oak Street from First to, or from Fifth to Front, and on 281 from Belmont to May, either 12th or 13th.
But I guess the question is, if you don't have space in front of your building because you have lampposts and bicycle stanchions and different things like that, could you put your seating in front of somebody else's establishment? That probably isn't going to work.
I know one of the issues also is that is OLCC. OLCC was letting them do like the parklet thing is a thing that OLCC was allowing, but you can't move it too far away from the business, or then it won't meet OLCC regulations.
Hmm. Yeah, so that's one of the issues that out of sight is if you move it too far out of sight, you have some OLCC complications. We've heard from some of the businesses regarding their ability to configure the table spaces based upon obstructions and their inability to make the sidewalk work. I think early on we recognized the tension between using and losing parking. So, you know, although the Ashland model may permit an entire side of their state highway to lose its parking, I believe there's probably a good amount of businesses that if they lost half of Oak Street in their entire block face, that there would be a significant outcry due to the value placed on that parking. So if we lost half of Oak Street's parking, you may have a lot of parklets, but I think you would also have some tension from the businesses that rely on that parking for both curbside. I mean, it's Oak Street parking. That's pretty significant real estate when it comes to the importance of those businesses.
And Mayor and Councilor, Councilor Zamula, go ahead.
So I guess I'm so astounded. How can they argue that it's safer to put pedestrians in wheelchairs in the street and move something that's exactly the size of a car out of a parking spot?
I can address that, Mayor, Councilors. My understanding, and this is even harder to understand personally, is that the issue is not the parklet, but it's the issue of the use given highway trust fund dollars.
Can you explain that further?
The guidance from this, the guidance that ODOT has given is that transportation dollars or that anything that has highway trust fund dollars needs to be used for transportation purposes, and pedestrian walking, pedestrians are considered a transportation element. So that is why it's the routing. It's not the parklets.
Can we lease back a prorated amount of those dollars, which would be like a quarter of a penny a day per foot or whatever?
We have looked into that option, and it's not a quick solution, and it's according to ODOT, perhaps not even a viable solution. So,
but if we
again,
if If we went into an IGA and the city essentially took over those sections of the road, then I guess two things. We probably wouldn't get funding from ODOT for some of these projects that we want to do. But secondly, we would still be under their purview to some extent to make them up to a certain standard. Is that true?
Yeah, I think those are some of the things that we would want to bring to council so that you really had a full understanding, could make an informed decision about what some of the trade-offs would be. I mean, on Second and Oak, for example, we are paying for the signal, but there would be other considerations, absolutely. Signal maintenance, signal operation. So absolutely, we would want council to be fully informed.
Megan?
So, I mean, I think I'm supportive of looking at what it would mean to take over a jurisdiction of Oak Street. Clearly that would be valuable if we had it now or in the future, or maybe it doesn't pencil out. But I guess that there is this time frame of if these businesses are being told they need to remove things like in the next week or I guess I don't know the time frame of like what. An IGA is clearly not going to occur in that time frame. So what are the options for like the next month or whatever it would be to just want to say like it's a pandemic, like can we just leave it alone? But is it something, I mean, that I guess that's not a short solution either of like can the legislature change how they deal with trust fund dollars or just make a special emergency something or.
Yeah, I think by the time we'd figure this all out, it's going to start raining and then the parklets aren't going to be valuable at that point anyway. I mean, maybe if they put some roofs over them, but it's going to be a lot more difficult to be using those if we can't get use out of them now.
Right. I guess that's just what's so painful is there doesn't seem to be any actual answer to the immediate need.
So frustrating.
So would there be a fine associated with leaving them there?
Councillor, I think that's something that we need to talk to ODOT about. My understanding is that ODOT would come and remove them.
Wow, that's radical.
What about like the businesses that have, the ones that have put money into it, are they going to get any sort of assistance with reimbursement?
Well, I think that's what Will was referring to that possibly we could do. Is that true?
Yeah, I think we can talk about some options to make them whole. But that doesn't solve the problem of not having appropriate physical space. So, Will, anything you want to add there?
No, I just confirm that is what I was referring to. We'll need to, run it through council and make it a program or under emergency. Anyway, it would be I think the bottom line is it would be a qualified expenditure for coronavirus relief funds.
So basically, I mean, oh, Councillor Haney, I'm sorry, did you have something?
Well, I was really asking the same question of Tim, because and I just don't know how ODOT's enforcement arm works, but it seems like typically there'd be a notice of violation, please respond in 30 days. And I just don't know if they're going to show up with a cat tomorrow. There could be a thoughtful risk taken to just continue to work with ODOT and wait for their notice of violation to see exactly what. But I'm not an expert in the matter, but I shared that same question Tim was, what's the actual downside risk and can we brave it?
Well, I guess is it us braving it or is this the business braving it? Because that's different.
Those are all important considerations, yeah. And I guess what I'm hearing is you'd be okay with putting together a letter, staff will work on that and having the mayor sign it to ODOT, to our representatives, to governor's office, asking them to reconsider at least during the pandemic or for the next 10 weeks, the permit goes till October 1, so through September, 10 weeks. And then also seeing if we can look at the options for a transfer and whether, you know, if an IGA could be executed quickly, that could be something that would still leave some time, you know, during the summer for these things to be in place. So happy to look at those things and continue to push this forward with your very clear direction, which we appreciate.
Thank you, Rachel.
I'm good on doing that. I mean, that I'm not sure what else we can do. I we need to push on them as much as we can. I don't want them to come and bulldoze people's parklets if they could be dismantled and reused to some extent. And I don't want them just taking them away and not giving those back. I know if there's signs in ODOT right away, they will just take them. You know, they just come along and grab them up and they're gone. So I wouldn't want that to happen. But I think we should push back as hard as we can. And I'm all for looking into an IGA. It may not be the way to go at all, but you know, we should go fully informed on what it would mean to do that. Is everyone okay with that?
I support both of those.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. We've got consensus on doing that then. Thank you, Rachel. Appreciate it.
Thank
you. For all those on the phone with the parklets, we're doing our best. We're just as mad as you are about it. We're really upset and we're going to try as hard as we can. Okay. Let's see. Where are we? Mayor call. Okay. I've got a few things. Let me get my notes here. Well, first of all, and maybe you've already heard, but we're going a little bit backwards on the COVID-19. I think Wednesday we go back to 10, no more than 10 people meeting indoors, and you also, and unless it's a regulated business already, for instance, restaurants are fine because they're already regulated with social distancing and masking and cleaning and all those kinds of things. But just general individual gatherings, no more than 10. And and if the numbers don't start improving, there may be more restrictions. I mean, that was kind of the message that the governor gave this morning, if you listen to her. Megan?
Since we're on COVID, I did want to kind of ask where the city was with the state of emergency timeline and everything.
Thank you, Councilor, Mayor, Councilors. We extended it for one more month, and the county extended theirs through the end of the year, so we're just going to keep plugging along.
And sorry, remind me, one more month is like mid-August at this point, or?
Beginning of August.
Okay, mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, great. I went to a bi-state bridge meeting, and we were supposed to have another one this week, but it's going to be moved, I believe, till next week. And we may be looking at a more official IGA between all the entities instead of just a working group. So that's one of the things that we're considering right now. We're also considering looking at a private company, private public partnership type thing. So we're going to look into that a little bit more thoroughly than has been done in the past. So things are kind of hopping along with that, and kind of exciting. You know, it's going to take years and years to do all this stuff, but things are actually happening on that group. Eric and Gladys and I met with Chief Holste and Don Chalet and Rachel on the use of force. And we actually had one thing that the chief recommended that we actually, if we want, we're going to remove it, we should just get it removed ASAP, and that was the chokehold language. And so we said, yes, we do not want that language. We all agreed that that wasn't a good thing to have in there, and so that is gone. There's some other changes that we need more information about, and we're meeting again tomorrow. And so by the next council meeting, we should have some more things for people on that. So the meeting went really well. And, you know, we have some ideas for next steps, so which will involve the public. So that went really super well. What else have I got here? Wade was on this phone call, and I believe Chief Damien was on this phone call, but Northwest Natural Gas is going to be replacing some large lines and expanding in some areas where they actually weren't able to provide enough natural gas to keep it going a few winters ago. So we're going to have quite some construction going on through the city over the next, I think it's about 2.5 months. So just be aware. And I believe, Rachel, we will be putting some information on our website when those things start happening and where those are going to be.
Sure, Mayor, we'd be happy to. Sure.
Okay, great. I think it would be helpful. It's going to start up by the public works, and the fire station is where it's going to start, and then it's going to kind of come down and weave its way through town, through downtown.
Yeah, I believe it started, so I'll check in with folks and make sure we get some information out.
Okay, great.
Question on that one, Kate. Are we replacing lead bits and old pottery pipes and stuff while they have it dug up, or is that not a possibility?
No, we're not ready for that. And they've had this in the works for quite some time. And they were actually hoping to do this in the spring before the tourist season happened. But they couldn't get all the permitting done prior to now. So this is when it's happening. But no, we're not ready for that. I don't know if it's even areas that would be in conjunction. Let's see here. Okay, there's a letter regarding, I don't know where that letter is. I think I may just send this to council, but there's a letter, so you guys can look at it, that would go to DLCD regarding natural hazards. And the Energy Committee has recommended that we would, the city and the county, we'd each have our own separate letters, but, and the Energy Committee, send a letter to DLCD regarding natural hazard mitigation, which would be discussing the PSPS, the public safety power shutoff. And Pacific Power is not 100% on board with all the language in it, but there's been several people on the Energy Committee that have said they really think the language should be as strong as it is to consider that, you know, maybe some funding should be used to help us get through what needs to be done to help with if the power is shut off. Even though is it going to be shut off in town, it definitely will be affecting us because it will be shut off. If it does go down, it will be shut off around Hood River. It will be in Hood River County. So it is going to affect the city. So I don't think we sent out that letter, did we, Rachel? Did you guys get that letter?
Jen sent it.
Yeah, we did get it.
You did get the letter. Okay, mm-hmm. All right. So I don't know if you guys have any questions about that letter, but I support signing that letter and sending it into DLCD. They may not consider it. They may not want to consider that part of it, but we thought it was a good shot to see if they might be able to add it, and it might be some funding for some things that we might need to do. Not necessarily for hardening the lines. That's up to the job of Pacific Power, but you know, islanding and different things like that in the future.
Did they extend the deadline, Kate? Because according to this letter, it ended 3.5 hours ago. So
I don't know that they've extended it. I don't know that the county sent theirs in yet.
Yeah, we asked, that came up, the energy count. This just came up last Thursday.
Yeah, last week.
And so I believe Marla knew that, I think she said Tuesday morning was the deadline for her, so.
Yeah, maybe she had called ahead of time. But if you guys are okay with me signing that, you know, it may just put something on their radar. They may not do anything about it, but.
I think it's an important issue for the community, and I do, you know, the city is no longer a part of it for Pacific Power, but I do still have concerns about the larger transmission lines through the gorge, given our summer weather in the future. So I think this is something that could come back around in other ways. So I think it's important to pursue.
Okay. If people aren't objecting to it, we'll send it in. Couple more things. The homeless task force has started doing some work. So we have a person that we've hired with the money that was given to us by Providence, and she started interviews of stakeholders, and I think those might be done in the next 2 weeks, and then they'll convene a meeting after she gets all the input from the stakeholders. So that's in process, which is great. And there's a new person who asked me if I would recommend them for the Gorge Commission position. There's a Gorge Commission position Dan Erickson in Wasco County, his position was up. And this is another person from Wasco County, and her name is Debbie Ferrer. And I told her I would sign her letter. I called some people that I know that have worked with her. She's a retired science teacher in the Dalles, and she works really well with groups and, you know, comes from the science background, so to speak. The people that have worked with her on different committees, she's gotten quite involved with a lot of different committees up in the Dalles since she's been retired and has time to put in to be on the Gorge Commission. I think there may be some other candidates, but I told her that I would recommend it her. I called her references and I talked to her personally, and I felt that she was, she would be a conscientious person on the Gorge Commission. So I just wanted to let you know I recommended her for that. That's all I've got. Megan? Okay. Tim?
With respect to the private-public partnership with the bridge, can you explain what that is?
So that's something that was quite some time ago, I think, 4 or 5 years ago maybe, the legislature made it possible for public entities such as the port to be able to enter into a partnership with a private entity, like for building the bridge. And there was all sorts of rules and regulations about it. And they did get an individual solicitation from a private party, but they didn't have all their ducks in a row, so to speak, at that time in order to actually look at that bid. So they do have that in place now. And so the committee, the working group, said, well, we should look into it. You know, not that we're going to do it, but we need to solicit. What does that mean? You know, how would it happen? Can they take care of doing some of this stuff that we're trying to do that you know, they do all the time as a private company? And so that's what it's just so that we could do an RFI. So the working group is looking at possibly doing an RFI for a private entity for the port or the working group, or if we become an official intergovernmental agreement between all these different entities, that group would work with the private company to build a bridge. Because right now we, you know, ODOT is saying no, WSDOT is saying no, there's no federal dollars. I mean, it's like, you know, the bridge might fall into the river before we get anything done. So we just need to look at all the possibilities. So that's what this is about.
So would they end up owning part of the bridge then? Or
Not necessarily. No, that's what we don't know. That's, you know, they might not. Yes, they might own part of it. But we really don't have enough information to answer that question. So this would be helping us answer that question.
Thank you.
That's all I've got. Mark?
I think the only other thing is, and Eric and Megan can add to this, is we had the multi-jurisdictional meeting about the Parks Master Plan in the last few days. When was it? Middle of last week, I guess.
Last week.
And went quite well. The city staff with Jennifer Caden did a marvelous job of organizing us and getting, we submitted 10 pages of comments. And I think the most any other organization did was say, so we were the squeaky wheel, and I think that it's going to work out to be a document that's quite useful for the city, I hope. So I'm happy with how we work together, and I'm happy with how city comments have been put into the document. So then the real work is, what do we do when it's done? How do we internalize it to use it for what we want to do? Other than that, I don't have anything.
Thanks, Mark. Gladys?
Yeah, I don't have much else to add. I think you summed up our meeting that we had beautifully. Just a reminder again to everyone to continue to wear your masks when you're out in public, washing your hands. If you are feeling sick, please make sure that you stay home, follow up with your primary care doctor. If you do not have access to a mask, please reach out, whether that's to the health department, to One Community Health. There are agencies like the Next Door, for example, as well. If you are unable to purchase a mask, there is support out there for everyone to have access to masks.
Thanks, Gladys. Jessica?
Thanks, Mayor. One thing I just wanted to say was good work to all the staff, because tonight's agenda had a lot of contracts that mean there's a lot of exciting new work that's going to be happening, and it's really moving our work plan forward. And so just thank you and good work to all the staff for those exciting new contracts. I was going to reference one good thing, and I don't know if you guys have seen this in other ways, but we do have through work, we have a grant program for businesses that have been impacted by COVID, grants and nonprofits, 501c3s that have not benefited from the federal dollars, the PPP, or the EIDL. So it just opened a week ago, but I believe there are still a little bit of dollars left for Hood River County. So if you guys know of anybody that would meet those criteria, you could send them to me. We also just to share, kind of tie back to Gladys's comments, but the Gorge Commission was updating their management plan, and the June 30th was the comment deadline, and I submitted some through work, but a lot of people have been really focused on what they are, the changes that they had proposed for how to amend the urban growth areas, which were pretty significant, and it could be very restrictive. All of its entirety, Hood River would only be able to expand 20 acres, or I think 0.1% ever. And I know Dustin knows more details, but anyway, just to say that, I had signed on with a lot of other partners to say, we need more time to look at this urban area. And plus also it said, if we don't have the budget, if we don't have the time, then, we don't have to ever really consider your request to expand your urban growth boundary, which, would be really detrimental to Wood River. So anyway, I think just something to flag. There's a lot of people that are watching this. I did also meet the new Hood River County Gorge Commissioner is Michael Mills, who I've known him through a work capacity, and I think he'd be a great addition. He's a longtime family up in the Parkdale area. So anyway, I did meet with him, and I'm glad to have him for the county. And I think that's it.
Thanks. Megan?
Yeah, I guess somewhat touching on Jessica's thing of I had seen some comments on the Gorge Commission's plans as it relates to potential expansions of the urban growth boundary. And I don't know when or how we would start that process, but it is concerning to me that it seems like the proposed changes basically write off any ability for us as a city to ever really do it at all. And I think we need to make sure that option stays on the table, because that's, whatever it is, whether it's in 5 years or 30 years or whenever, that I don't think it's realistic to think that the city will never need to change our boundaries. But I don't really know how to engage in that process at this point, given our staff capacity and I think council capacity. And then just real quick, I was wondering if anyone was planning to go to the Merkley meeting on Thursday. Okay. Maybe I'll leave it to you three and go to the reservoir. I think that's all I have. So, thanks.
Eric?
Thank you, Mayor. I think just three brief points. First, Mark hit on the Parks Master Plan. I think we're going to have that before council soon. It's just in its final turn. And again, kudos to city staff for really taking a laboring oar on that. Second, with respect to the use of force subcommittee, I thought maybe I agree. Everything the mayor said was great. I appreciated her comments. I might just emphasize what I think is the importance and the significance of what did happen this past week. And give council a little sense of what we did. It was a long meeting and it was good. We spent something on the order of 2.5 hours going through the city police department's use of force policy. And the mayor had a lot of constructive input that was very positive and contributed to the discussion. Councilor Rivera had a lot of constructive input that I thought contributed to the discussion. And the city or the police chief did. And it was not only at the suggestion of Councilor Rivera, the mayor, and myself, but also the police chief himself agreed that we can, as a city, eliminate the chokehold as an authorized form of use, an express authorized form of use from our code, from the use of force code, which is something the police chief has discretion over. And given everything's happening in our country and what happened to George Floyd, I just think it's notable that our community came together when we did this. And there's more work to be done, don't get me wrong, but it just was tangible to me and meaningful to me for that to be eliminated from the use of force policy. There is some state law issues that come into play if there's a true emergency with life-saving measures that a police officer can take. But as far as our city code goes, we have written that out with the blessing of the three of us and the blessing of the police chief. So to me, that was just meaningful. And I just wanted to share that. And not that, again, we have more work to do, but that did happen last week and that has been accomplished. The last thing I'll just say is very briefly, there was reference earlier in the discussion of the Morrison Park issue. And we have so many things going on. I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about this. But we might as a group consider pivoting our time and attention and resources to the Rand Road project, given all the history of that. And I know there's a big history with that. I'm not intending to bring it up. Just to maybe just put a little pin in that would be something to discuss at a later time. Thank you.
Tim?
Thanks, Mayor. I really don't have much to add. But I do want to acknowledge the hard work of Jessica and Megan on the resolution. And I appreciated working with them on that.
Yeah, got you, Tim.
Yeah, we've been doing a lot of work behind the scenes and it's been really, really good. Really appreciate everyone putting in all the extra time lately. It's difficult, and especially we need to do all this on Zoom meetings, and feels a little bit different and weird, but we're getting work done even though we can't meet in person. So thank you so much, appreciate it. I think that's it. Unless we have anything else, we'll adjourn the meeting at 8:49. Thank you, everyone. Good night.